Welcome to Gospel Conversations. We're starting a new series now after our Cross and Creation series, and we're calling this series, What is the Gospel? Now, you will recall in the Cross and Creation series, we were critiquing the model of penal substitution and searching for better models. One of the challenges with the penal substitution model is that it is a very evocative mental picture. It's very easy for people to get and to understand, and it also is very evocative. I mean, there are some images or mental landscapes that we can get people to inhabit that for whatever reasons seem to evoke deep reactions in their psyche, reactions perhaps of anxiety or fear, and the whole mental landscape of criminal liability and judgment and retribution and punishment is one such metaphorical landscape. Now, we can critique it and we can theologically put out better ideas, and I think we've done that and others are doing it too, but really what we also need is better pictures of what the gospel is, and they should be pictures. So the question is, you know, what would be an alternative mental landscape to the whole judicial system? What would be an alternative mental landscape? And that's what we're going to explore in this series of What is the Gospel? And we're going to begin with the gospel according to Exodus. The big idea, the simple big idea, is that the narrative of Exodus, the extended narrative of Exodus, is actually a powerful, it's a biblically endorsed model of God's redemption work with Israel, and we would argue with all of humanity. Now, there can't be much argument about this if you just turn your mind, for instance, to the what we call the Old Testament. It's clear that their model for God's intervention, the paradigm from which they seemed to draw their lessons and which captured their yearnings, was the Exodus. It was not a judicial model. They did not have a judicial model of God's redemptive activity. For the model of God's redemptive activity, clearly they went to Exodus. And our simple idea is, well, why shouldn't we do the same? In fact, we should do the same. What I'm aiming for here is ambitious, which is a paradigm shift, to get into a space where our mind can begin to be stretched. Now, I think that's what the story of Exodus will do to our model of redemption. It'll stretch us. It'll give us a new metaphorical landscape. And it will also, I think, do more than stretch. I think it'll change and transform some of the key elements in the redemptive activity. So let's get going. Now, in order to go with me on this journey, I need to explain the thinking methodology that I'm going to employ. It's a methodology that we used extensively in Second Road when we wanted to get clients to not just think creatively, but to actually think transformatively. And the trouble with thinking transformatively is when you've got an old mental model that constricts your mind, a bit like, you know, ruts in a road, the wheels will just keep going down the ruts. So in order to change that, you need to put in quite a lot of work. And we used a powerful model. We called it crossing the river. In fact, it's really the use of extended metaphor in order to shift paradigms. So I think the way this can work is at the conscious level, but it can go deeper into the subconscious level and begin to seep down into our souls. That's my goal. So what you do in the crossing the river exercise is this. Let's say you have a problem or you have an issue and that problem or that issue is one for which you just can't find better ways of thinking, because all of your ways of thinking seem to be tied too tightly to the present situation. So you're on that side of the river. What you need to do is build a bridge and go across the river to the other side of the river and put that take that problem with you, but put it into a very, very different landscape and pursue the problem, pursue the flow of the problem and its issues, but do it in a different landscape. Don't come back to your side of the river. Just let your mind begin to associate different connotations and associations with the problem. And then when you've done that and let that cook a while, it might be an hour, it might be a day, it might be weeks, then bring the problem back again to your side of the river and see what new ideas and paradigms now you can situate the problem in. And this technique is very, very powerful, very, very effective. I've used it effectively in business quite a lot. Now, so that's what we're going to do. And what we'll do in the first talk is take the issue of quote unquote redemption or salvation and take it out of its, let's call it, reformed religious box on our side of the river with all of its connotations, and let's take it to the other side of the river, Egypt and the Exodus. Now, as we do this, one thing to bear in mind is that you need to take the whole extended narrative, so not just a verse or two, not just an incident or two, but let's take the Exodus event as a sweep of narrative. We need to take the whole lot across, and we're going to do that, which in practice will be initially the first 14 chapters of Exodus. That's the whole story. That's what we take across. As we do it, I want to introduce to you a important concept of how to interpret scripture, which is somewhat building on the way the patristics interpreted scripture, somewhat, it's not exactly the same, but close enough to it. And anyway, it's the way you read all great literature. And it is a layered level. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, look, narrative is at base level, that's level one, a set of events that look like they're intriguing and capture our attention. So let's call that the narrative level. If a story's any good, everybody knows there's more going on in that story than just a sequence of activities. There's a meaning. And so we'd go up a level to a higher level of what's going on here, what's behind the scenes, what's the interpretation that the novelist, the dramatist is inviting us to move into. So I'll give you a simple example from the great novel Sons and Lovers by D.H. Lawrence. There's a famous passage where nothing at the narrative level, all that's going on is the young lover and his girlfriend are at the mother-in-law's, future mother-in-law's, house eating scones with some friends. So you couldn't get anything more mundane. Apparently it's trivial. Apparently there's no meaning. But it's the most excruciating passage, because at the level up, you know that there's the battle between the mother-in-law and the daughter, sexual battle really, over the possession of the son. There's competition over who's going to eat the last scone, and it's absolutely excruciating. So that's a level up, and you could possibly at times go up higher. So the idea of levels is something which I think we're pretty familiar with in literature, good literature that is. Well, let's treat the Exodus story as good literature. And I want to suggest there's three levels we're going to look at. So the first level, let's call it the dramatic level, the narrative level. And at that level, what we're looking at is a tale of liberation. So it's like a refugee crisis. It's an escape story. That's a level that is very dramatic and we can really identify with in our day and age with refugee crises around the world. However, clearly the way the text is handled directly, you know, there's a higher level up. And I'm going to call that level a cosmic level, that we know something's going on behind the scenes here. This seems to be the tale, not just of liberation, but a tale of a cosmic struggle. There's a cosmic struggle going on behind the scenes. Certainly Yahweh's involved, so straight away that's lifted it to the level of cosmic. But our invitation is to lift Pharaoh to a cosmic level of supernatural power. And in doing that, we're probably, you know, it's semi-Platonic. In other words, we're lifting it to a metaphysical level. The patristics always then went one level higher. And one level higher was the Christocentric level. And they did that because they believed all of creation and history and the events of history were created, as it says in Colossians, by him and through him and for him. That Christ as the Logos was the template of all creation and the template of all redemptive activity. Colossians 1:15, you know, famously is an epic declaration of this really Platonic landscape overtaken by Christ. It says Christ is the firstborn of all creation, because in him all things in the heavens and on earth, the visible as well as the invisible, whether thrones or lordships or archons or powers, all things were created through him and for him. And that is the third, the highest level. Now, in the first talk, I'm not going to go to that level. Let's just cross the river and keep it mostly at the cosmic struggle level. So what I'll do in the next half an hour or so is just retell that Exodus story and unpacking it, moving it from layer one to layer two, from a liberation tale to a cosmic struggle layer. And I want that to sort of cook in your minds, in my minds as well, before we take it back and say, well, what does this now tell us? How does this reframe the whole way we look at God's activity of redemption? The first thing to see is the problem state. Now, I don't like the word problem for a variety of reasons. You've probably heard me talk about that. A richer word is the situation. So situations can be problematic, but they need not be specifically problematic. They can be situations of restriction, constraint, opportunity. And the word situation is a bigger word. It's a complex of an interplay of relationships, histories, tensions. So the situation we've got is actually a situation of slavery. Now, straight away, you can intimate this is different from the penal model, where the situation we have in redemption is primarily a model of guilt or sin. This is not the model in Exodus. We begin with slavery. So the situation that we are confronted with is that's problematic or that's challenging is much better described as bondage. We're looking at a group of people who are in bondage in Egypt. And they're in bondage under a tyrannical system in the face of which they're helpless. They really are helpless. Now, straight away you have the entrance into that landscape of their antagonist, and that is Pharaoh. So Pharaoh is introduced as hostile, hard-hearted, and egotist, and he becomes the bitter rival of Moses. So a really powerful way to read the story is this is an arm wrestle between Moses and Pharaoh. Now, again, straight away, you can begin to see a shift here that this is not seeing God as our enemy, but Pharaoh as our enemy. Behind Pharaoh, there are magical powers. The whole battle is positioned as a battle between his musicians, priests, and the powers of Moses and Aaron. And that is an invitation straight away to say this is a battle at the cosmic level behind some of those archons and powers that later on Paul in Colossians mentions. Now, Israel's situation is by no means are they presented as pure. They're not innocent. They're actually a group of whingers. But that's not the primary lens on them. The primary lens is that they are helpless slaves in bondage to an owner and a system that they are helpless in the face of. Now, the situation, the problem actually doesn't stay there. Very importantly, the problem is stretched and begins earlier. It's stretched back into Genesis. And what stretches it back into Genesis, in Exodus 3, for instance, when God reveals himself to Moses, he says, "I am the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Now, that's not insignificant. That's actually very significant because it's evoking now something that predated this problematic situation, which was the promise of blessing to Abraham, the establishment of a covenant with Abraham. So now although they're in bondage now, they're linked back to a promise of blessing. And so Pharaoh's Pharaoh's evil is now positioned as interfering with the intention of God to bless, and in fact, robbing God of his people. So, stretched back, problem stretched back, and then what we see is a contest starts, and the contest is a contest over ownership. That's very important to bear that in mind. The key dispute is who owns these people, Yahweh or Pharaoh? That's the nature of the dispute. So that's how the story begins in the land of bondage with a battle over ownership. Who owns these people? Now, from the beginning, however, we don't just have a problem that needs to be solved. We don't even have a situation. We also have a vision. Now, a word about the importance of vision in any situation. If all you have is a problem that gets solved, then the solution is defined, as it were, by the problem. The solution is a reaction to the problem. That's always the case. It's a very limiting factor. But if you have, yes, you might have a problem, but if you have a purpose or a vision, now the solution gets stretched and reframed as a means to achieve the vision. That's quite different, and you'll come up with different ideas. In the case, and you can see straight away where this could go in the redemptive landscape we inhabit, that if we allow the problem to be sin and the cross to be, then the cross is minimized as a mere rescue plan, so it's now reduced to being defined by sin. Exodus doesn't begin that way. As we said, it begins with a vision. Exodus 6 says this, right? "I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from slavery to them. and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. Good, that's the promise of getting you out of this sticky situation so far. But now it moves to promise. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham. I will give it to you as a possession. Not I'll take you out, but I'll take you in. So the whole of the Exodus redemptive event is seen as a purpose-driven exercise, not as the reaction to a problem. And that purpose, we know, will be that the people of God will inhabit a new home. They'll have a new home. They'll create a new social system there with a new identity. And it won't just be a new home. It'll actually be a new role, because again, Exodus makes clear that Israel is God's firstborn. And so the movement of Israel is from slavery, not to freedom, but to sonship. Now, that's very important, because in the ancient Near Eastern world, the firstborn sons inherited the entire estate of the father. Just let that sink in. Its connotations are pretty wonderful. So by saying, I want Israel, to my firstborn son, to be free, God, Yahweh, in fact, is saying, the Lord is saying, he's implying not just freedom, but rule and authority. He's going to put them in a position where they have rule and authority. That's part of the vision. So we're definitely going to get a change in ownership. This is the massive from to transformation. But it's not merely from one kind of bondage to another kind of bondage. You know, for instance, you could imagine a situation where their freedom is achieved, but they still live in Egypt. Somehow or other, you can imagine that story happening. But that's not the case here. If they still lived in Egypt, they would still, the freedom would not be accomplished. The rule would not be accomplished. The vision would not be accomplished. They're moving from a situation where their owner is a despot to a situation where their new owner is their father. I am the corollary of sonship is fatherhood. You're moving into the fatherhood of God and inheriting all that that brings with it. Now, so that's how the narrative, that's the framing of the narrative. Now we get on to the whole passage of the redemption, the redemptive work that we see dramatically played out in Exodus. So this is the solution area. And we are moving here as we think this through. There is a contest. There is an immense arm wrestle. There is an immense contest and struggle going on. But it's not in a court of law. It's not a judicial concept over codes of law and that. It's much closer to a cosmic arm wrestle, a battle of immense powers. So the word about redemption, redemption or salvation, suffers from being a religious word. And as such, I think it does some work, but it's nice sometimes to take it out into a broader context. And I want to introduce to you the concept of God having to work. God having to work to get his people out. And if you think about it a little bit, this is completely counterintuitive to other pictures of God in the Bible as omnipotent and sovereign. He could normally just command and declare things and they happened. But it appears that for this quote-unquote redemptive work to happen, God has to work. And the question is, well, why? Why does God have to work? We're going to get into how he works, but why? And I think the answer is, as we, because I'm now moving back and forth to some extent between the analogy and the cosmic struggle, it goes back into where Genesis, Exodus itself goes back. God has a project. The project is for humanity to rule the cosmos and creation. God therefore has to work within, and being human means that acting in the world is always work for us. We can't command things to happen and they happen. We have to work, we have to think them through, we have to plan, etc., etc., etc. And that's the system God set up. Now, God wants to be part of that system. He wants to help us with that system. But if he overrides that system and says, I'm just going to nuke Pharaoh, click my fingers and stick you in Canaan, there is no work. And the whole redemption, the whole creational project of creating human beings who are in the image of God and work like God is finished. So that's the concept of, a little bit on the concept of work, a concept we'll return to later in the year in Gospel Conversations. The redemptive work. So this is now the struggle. And all of us know what this is like. In other words, vision, in a sense, costs you nothing. Vision is free. I mean, I don't think it's easy, and I think vision will always result in action. So I don't minimize vision, but it doesn't cost you anything to sit and have a dream. Cost you something to now bring that dream into reality. And that's what we're looking at. The first thing we see is that redemption is enacted in a person. So for God to work in the created order, within the constraints of creation that he set up, within those boundaries, he must work through the vehicles of creation, not his divinity. And that means a person, and that means a person who is a leader, who's going to fulfill the Genesis mandate to rule and govern. Now, we know that person is Moses. So the baby Moses arises as a redeemer. And there's going to be, it's his agency, it's his faith, it's his activities that are going to be, that God is going to use. God's going to work with him. So I'm not saying Moses works on his own, and God is going to work in a synergy, a partnership with Moses. That's what we see happening. So what we see happening is a double dialogue. Yes, we see Moses interacting with Pharaoh, but we see Moses interacting with God, and he's also debating with God. I mean, he's a skeptic, Moses. He has to be assured, and I think we can all identify with that in our lives. So the baby is born, and the picture of the baby floating down the river, that's pretty interesting. It seems to foreshadow the Red Sea. Certainly, it seems to be a picture of extreme vulnerability. All the promises and hopes of Israel are in this baby, and the baby has to escape death. So the baby, Moses, has to become incarnate in Egypt. As we know, he gets rescued and taken into the school of Pharaoh, and he is schooled as a prince. That's quite important, because he's now, what's setting up is a rivalry with Pharaoh. I mean, why could he go and talk to Pharaoh so freely? If you're just slaves, you can't do that. But he's actually a bit of both. He's a Jew and he's a prince. And we can begin to see here some foreshadowing of the incarnation. It's because he's a prince, because he knows the language of Egypt, because he's extremely intelligent, he's educated, he's got networks. That's how he can go into the court of Pharaoh and talk to him. So that's the setup, the redemptive person. Now, the redemptive activity is a sequence of events. It's not just one thing. And importantly, it begins with self-disclosure. So it begins with a burning bush in Exodus 3. It doesn't begin with the struggle. It begins with, as it were, the struggle between God and Moses, God and mankind. God has to introduce himself. Why? Because God needs and wants Moses as a conscious partner in his activities, not as a mere instrument, not as a puppet. He has to act with understanding. That's part of redemption, is bringing light into a dark space. I love the song that says, to know him is to love him. It's a pop song, but you know, I don't think it was written about God, but I think there's a sort of a religious connotation. And I've often thought about that what's true, it's true in all relationships, to know someone is to love them. And the more deeply you know someone, you can't love someone you don't know. And that's how love grows. So that's what's being set up here. It isn't just knowledge as formulaic knowledge, philosophical knowledge. It's knowledge of a person, who is going to become a companion. Interestingly, this conversation happens outside the system of Egypt. Moses has moved out of Egypt. He's actually in the wilderness when that happens. And in a way, that had to happen. He as a slave, if he's either housed in Egypt as a rival prince or as a slave, he's too much in the situation. He goes to a desert place to get this first principles picture of God. I do wonder whether Shakespeare and King Lear was somewhat inspired by this. I mean, it's when the great breakthrough in Lear is when he's on the heath and everything's taken away, and it's him in the wilds of nature, and he sees the primal forces of nature that he starts to get deep. And that feels to me like Moses out there in the desert having these epic conversations with God. And of course, the very famous announcement, is it, who are you, God? And the famous announcement, I am that I am. It's been so evocative and so much is written about it. But I am that I am is introducing the knowledge of God on the earth, the knowledge of the omnipotent, omniscient archetype of all reality. There are no reference in that statement. Normally, if I want to introduce myself or explain an idea, I'd say, look, I am Tony. I am the son of, and I am the father of, and I am the husband of, and I, you know, did this as a job. So we get reference that refer me back to those things so people can connect me. Now, the trouble with a referent is they're all created. They're all created. So for God to say, I, and elsewhere he does, of course, we know, use metaphors. But if at this first introduction, I'm like, I'm a rock, or I'm faithful, or I'm this, or I'm that, now he has located himself into the created order. And Moses begins with this really pure vision of God. George Athos, in his great article on the Exodus, says that that I am that I am can be translated as past, present, and future. And in a sense, God's all of those. I framed your past, I'm with you in the present. I want to achieve the future with you. I'm with you on the journey. So that's where redemption begins, self-disclosure and revelation. And then the struggle begins. And the struggle begins with the plagues. And the plagues are like a cosmic arm wrestle for ownership of the people. Clearly now the battle is, and as we read the story of the plagues, what that evokes for me is Paul's picture that we wrestle not with flesh and blood, but with principalities and powers, the rulers of the darkness of this world. And it doesn't matter whether you think of the plagues and the devils and the demons as literal or metaphorical. It doesn't really matter. What's not metaphorical is cosmic forces behind the rulers of this era. Cosmic forces. And they may evidence themselves in actuality, like supernatural events, but they're evidencing themselves in ideas, bad ideas. They're evidencing themselves in bad decisions. They're evidencing themselves in ego-driven violence and self-interest. So that's the arm wrestle. It's a behind-the-scenes arm wrestle. Now, there are definitely plagues, 10 of them, but there are also debates. You'll notice that the struggle is also a verbal struggle. So there are conversations where Pharaoh and Moses are going at one another, and it's prince versus prince. That's how it should be read. It's prince versus rival prince. It's prince with all the status, trappings of power, and prince, educated, intelligent, no apparent trappings of power. But both are princes, prince versus prince. So we can see these battle over the plagues is a battle of worldviews, the battle of governorship, and it's a battle in practice. This was a battle of polytheism versus monotheism, because the Egyptians were polytheistic. Their views of God were, as John Walton and Ian Proven have adequately, wonderfully explained to us, their views of God were domesticated, shrunken, bitchy, like middle managers of the universe. That was the prevailing monopolistic religion of the ancient Near Eastern world. What's about to be broken out into the world is the picture of God now that the entire world has, which is monotheism. Whether the world believes it or doesn't believe it, it's dominant. And that's what was at play here. The battle of the knowledge of God as whimsical, because the ancient Near Eastern gods were whimsical. They were untrustworthy. You didn't know. One thing's for sure, they were not on your side. Versus a God who is faithful. A God who said, I am that I am, and I'm not moving. A battle over the perspective on what it is to be a human being. The ancient Near Eastern world had a view that all human beings were slaves, slaves of the gods, except the king, of course, versus a picture of all humanity made in the image of God, male and female, made in the image of God, which has become the bedrock of civil liberties and democracy in the modern world. So, a lot going on in the debates. The battle over the snakes is very interesting, because that is also very evocative, you know, back to Genesis 3, obviously. But it's snake versus snake. I'm playing with that in my mind. I could probably do a little discrete session on that. I won't go into it now. George Athos has got some wonderful commentary on it in the paper he wrote, where he notices that when Moses's snake confronts the snakes of the magicians, the word for snake changes into something more like the Job-like language of a you know, massive sea serpent or something. So anyway, won't go there now, but let's move on. Redemption then moves to probably the one area that's come to dominate in the Christian mind is the blood on the doorposts. And that clearly is some kind of evocative of the blood shed for the remission of sins. And indeed it is. But importantly, it's important to notice the blood does not complete the redemptive activity. It begins it, it doesn't complete it. It's not finished. What it does is it preserves the Israelites from the angel of death and gives them a immunity, but it's something that is the beginning of their freedom, not the accomplishment of it. The accomplishment of their freedom is with the Red Sea or the Reed Sea. And that is what completes their redemption. Now, the Reed Sea passing through the waters, this is not a penal, when we take it back to the other side, this is not a penal metaphor. This is a metaphor that is creational and will be associated with the resurrection. when we come to talk about it later on. So, as we know, they pass through the waters part for them, and they pass to the other side. They pass to the other side. And this passing through waters on dry land is a very clear echo of Genesis 1 and the act of creation. The act of creation, where God drew the land out of the waters. So that, and in Genesis 1, that imagery of waters being drawn out, of the dry land being drawn out of the waters is a much used symbol, not just in the Old Testament, but throughout the ancient Near East, where the waters are chaos and the land is order. In their world, clearly, if all we have is waters and turbulence, you can't build anything on waters. You can't build cities, you can't build roads, you can't grow fruit, you can't do anything if all you've got is waters. You need to draw the land out of the waters, and the waters can then be tamed and go into a weather cycle and feed the land, but you need the land. So the imagery, when, particularly in the Old Testament, but in other ancient Near Eastern texts, is the waters are chaos and the land is the order that can come out of chaos. And clearly, the passage through the Red Sea is evoking and drawing on Genesis 1, where they, if all they had was the Red Sea, they're trapped. Chaos and mess is all that's in front of them. They're caught, sandwiched between that and the pursuing armies of Pharaoh. There's nowhere to go. Chaos in front, chaos behind. The waters part, and instead of chaos, there's dry land, and they pass through it. So straight away, you can begin to see that in this Exodus framing, redemption is being framed by the creation account. In other words, and it's doing that very clearly, I don't think there's any debate over that, because not just Exodus uses the language of Genesis, but the later prophets, when they're referring back to Exodus, use the language of Genesis. So we can see there was a continuity in the Jewish prophet's mind here between Genesis, creation, Exodus, redemption, and their hopes for the future. So what does this do with this kind of idea of redemption? Well, it is establishing redemption as a continuation of the work of creation. Something began in creation that is now evolving and developing in redemption. That all, quote unquote, redemption work, all, quote unquote, salvation work is a fulfillment of what of the creation mandate, and is to be seen as a new creation and new creations. So that's clearly what's in play here. And so seeing redemption as primarily a creative exercise is now the big idea that now we've been led into. Ooh, this is a long way from a judicial system. It's a creation system. Okay, the story continues, as we know, with the pursuing armies of Pharaoh. And what happens is Pharaoh is lured by an insane jealousy. I think he is presented as a, with all the kind of manic jealousy and insanity that seems to take over some of the worst examples of despots that we know of in history. I won't mention modern ones, where they, and it is an insanity that, I mean, you know, they've got enough, they've got kingdoms, why do they want more? They need to control everything. And any lapse in that, any rebellion is a psychological dagger in their heart. To be honest, I think that's why Putin killed Navalny, because he didn't need to. Navalny's in prison. What is it? It was just digging into his ego that this guy is there. As small as he was, he was challenging this terrible, black, maniacal jealousy. So that's what we see in Pharaoh. We see that he's ruled by violence and terror. That's his modus operandi. But what happens is the same waters that parted for the Israelites now engulf Pharaoh's armies. The waters engulf Pharaoh's armies. So what is happening if we continue the Genesis echoes? Chaos is meeting chaos. The forces of chaos in Pharaoh, which are forces of violence and terror and disorder and chaos, now meet the forces of chaos in the waters. And death kills the owner of death, as it were. The victory is interesting because the forces of chaos that confront each other are different forces of chaos. Pharaoh's is the military chaos of violence and terror, but the greater chaos that consumes it is the chaos of the waters of nature that eats it up. Moses and Israel win by doing nothing but watching it happen. That's what they're told. Wait and see what God, the salvation of the Lord. The Egyptians you see today, you will see no more forever. They will be obliterated. They will be obliterated. So the cosmic forces behind Pharaoh meet the cosmic forces behind Israel, and they're defeated by them. But not in a battle. It's not as if what we see here finally is, you know, Moses musters an army and they meet Pharaoh's army, and because God's the cosmic force behind Moses' army, he beats Pharaoh. No, that's not what we see at all. If we did that, in a way, God is playing the Pharaoh game. God is playing the dark game. Instead, we see, in fact, Moses does nothing, but God, it's the forces of creation that destroy the forces of military muscle. Now, so the redemptive landscape has this sweep through all of these events, climaxing in the Red Sea, Reed Sea. Now, the Red Sea, Reed Sea can only be understood when we look at it in the second talk in more detail as the resurrection. Now, we've already got that foreshadowed because, as I said, it is very much positioned as creation and new creation. And I'll conclude with this point. Great example of that is Isaiah 43. Now, Isaiah 43 is very well known, wonderful passage, very comforting passage to many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people over centuries, because it's got the wonderful poetic promises of God restoring. And then the famous verses are 19 and 20. Remember not the former things, nor consider the things of old. Behold, I'm doing a new thing. Now it springs forth. Do you not perceive it? And those are wonderful, wonderful words, which we can often, and I have in my life, taken into situations I'm in, which are, you know, I feel chained up and I feel small and diminished, and I felt the Holy Spirit, you know, give me that promise. And I think that's valid. But let's look at the whole chapter through the lens of what we've just been talking about. And what I'm going to suggest is that what Isaiah is drawing on in Isaiah 43 is the Red Sea, the Exodus. That's what he's drawing on. Because it begins, but he's looking back and telescoping the Exodus event and the Genesis event. He's kind of telescoping them together. So Isaiah 43 begins, "This is the Lord who created you, O Jacob, and formed you, O Israel." That's interesting. The language was not saved you, redeemed you, but I created you. When was Israel created? When was it formed? That's the language of Genesis 1, but they were not created in Genesis 1. they were created in the Exodus. So from the very first verses of 43, we're getting the fusion of a Genesis view and an Exodus view, redemption view and a creation view. Immediately, the promise goes on, which now takes that language directly into the Exodus. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. I read that verse many times as a young Christian and got a lot of comfort out of it, and that's fantastic. Never occurred to me really what he's drawing on explicitly is the Exodus event. Pass through the waters. I'm going to take you through the waters. I'm going to take you through the waters. I'll be with you. Clearly, that's what he's alluding to. And then it continues, but says the Lord, now I've jumped ahead to verse 15, 16, something like that. But says the Lord, who makes a way in the sea, who makes a path in the mighty waters, who brings forth chariot and horse, army and warrior. They lie down, they cannot rise, they are extinguished and quenched like a wick. So now he's absolutely explicitly drawing on the destruction of the forces of chaos, the destruction of Pharaoh's armies. That was my salvation. I beat them for you. Then he goes on and says, I'm going to do a new thing. I'm going to do it. Forget all the old. I'm going to do a new thing. As in, now the language of doing a new thing is clearly the language of creation. And the redemptive work that is being promised and alluded to in the past here is a work positioned, not in any metaphorical landscape that in any way, shape or form could be called judicial, with an antagonism between God and man. It's an antagonism between God and Pharaoh over who owns humanity. The landscape is one of creation and the project of creation continuing. Obviously, the work in Exodus is just beginning. I mean, Exodus 16 Exodus 15, you know, is the song they sing when they come out. It's a song that is a song of redemption, and it's a song of God's mighty arm. So the whole Exodus event, the whole passage of those first 14 chapters, is a picture of God's redemptive and salvation work happening. So we put ourselves in that landscape and we say, that's interesting. I need to put myself mentally in that landscape. Bondage, slavery, a despotic ruler I can't get out of. But back to Genesis, a promise to bless. And the work I began in Genesis, I'm going to continue that work. I'm going to exercise that work in history to bring about a redemption and bring my people home to myself. And that redemption can only be accomplished in the end when I extinguish all of their enemies in a cosmic victory. So I'll leave it there. I've been thinking about this Exodus story as the major metaphorical landscape in which we should think through the details of redemption, the mechanics of redemption, if you want to put it that way. It is a metaphorical landscape, which means that the ideas we come up would be suggestive and directional rather than formulaic, for sure. But nonetheless, I don't think there can be any argument that if we were to ask ourselves, I mean, Luther and Calvin were lawyers and they had a situation in their world where they went to legal paradigms. But did the Bible see God's redemptive salvation work through legal paradigms? No. They saw it primarily through the Exodus paradigm of freedom from bondage and slavery into sonship. Uh, So in the next talk, I will bring this problem that we've now, or the issue that we've investigated, back to our side of the river, which will be, okay, well, let's now, in a more sustained way, work through some of the analogies and how some of these events and themes of a cosmic struggle, if we took it up to the next layer, what does it reveal about the ultimate work of God in Christ, the ultimate work of Calvary, the ultimate work of incarnation and redemption of the human condition?